It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Ah, Thanksgiving, the bane of nervous cooks. But fear not, we've a lineup of experts like Australia's master of easy, Donna Hay. And she has experienced the feast firsthand.
It was quite a few years ago with some American friends of mine back in Sydney. And it was a really big deal. They were really stressed, running around. They wanted to do it absolutely perfectly. But I think because they put so much pressure on themselves, it didn't quite work out. And was there marshmallows in a salad or was that I dreaming?
Culinary heavy hitters this week, Donna Hay, Adam Rappaport of Bon Appetit, and Indian chef Vikas Khanna. All here to help with the feasting this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. If there was ever a time to streamline your cooking, next weekend is the weekend. So we're turning to a woman who has made a career out of easy, Donna Hay, who is taking on what many of us consider to be the best part of the Thanksgiving feast, the sides. Her latest book is aptly titled The New Easy. Donna and producer Sally Swift got to talk.
Donna Hay, welcome back.
Thanks, Sally.
Have you ever sat down to an American Thanksgiving dinner?
Yes, I have.
And tell me your perspective on that.
It was quite a few years ago with some American friends of mine back in Sydney. And it was a really big deal. They were really stressed, running around. They wanted to do it absolutely perfectly. But I think because they put so much pressure on themselves, it didn't quite work out. And was there marshmallows in a salad or was that a dream?
There probably were marshmallows in the salad.
Right, just, okay.
Which gets me to the salad. And the reason we have asked you here today is I want to take a fresh look at some of our side dishes, which to me is the main event for Thanksgiving and for many people as well. And I think we tend to do the same things over and over. So we're coming to you for some advice. And I'm wondering if you will take on a classic. One of the things that is on many, many people's table on Thanksgiving is roasted squash. What would you do as an alternative?
Okay. So it's usually quite plain, isn't it?
Yep, it's usually pretty plain.
Well, I think we should kind of spice it up a bit.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Well, I think that roasted squash is one of my favorites. But what I like to do with it is roast it with something more with a kick, like some nice dried chorizo and some tomatoes, some marjoram leaves, some French eschalots. And what I like to do is just put it all on one tray together and roast that. So the squash is also, because it has a natural sweetness, then with the spice of the chorizo, it all melds together. And then I like to put it with a smoky paprika, maple syrup, red wine, really simple dressing over the top.
Oh my gosh, that sounds delicious.
Really delicious. The sweetness of the maple in the dressing. Yum.
That's more Thanksgiving than anything we Americans do, I have to say. Now, what about some salad alternatives for that table?
Well, let's do something super crispy and crunchy and kind of refreshing because there's a lot going on at Thanksgiving. So my favorite pick would be the celery and apple salad. And for a few reasons, I love this salad because it's layers of celery. So it's celery root, really finely cut, which is raw and crunchy. And then I've got stalks of celery, really thinly sliced. And then the really small, quite pale celery leaves.
Which most people really throw away, right?
Yeah. They have a really great flavor. So you use those really small leaves. And then to offset that celery flavor, really thinly sliced green apple, which has that sweetness, but of course the tartness to it as well. So that's just a really simple combination, really pretty with the celery leaves.
It sounds delicious. And what would you dress that with?
Well, I like a little bit more on that. I'm working with the apple flavor. I'm more likely to combine the same flavors. So I like to make a dressing of apple juice, apple cider vinegar, grain mustard, a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, something, you know, it's fruity, but it's delicate because you don't want to overpower those flavors. But that's a perfect dressing to go over that.
It'd be perfect against that turkey. And what about you often do pickled things? Do you have an idea for a pickled condiment for the Thanksgiving table?
Yeah, I can. I do a great pickled carrot and radish salad. So that's got quite a bit of zing to it with the radish and the pickle. It's a good one because the carrots only need to pickle for 30 minutes. So it's nice and quick. You can prepare the carrots in advance. They just need to be blanched for 30 seconds because I like them with a lot of bite and crispness to it. And the pickle, again, a nice fruity apple cider vinegar. And the pickle's flavored with two of my favorites, dill and juniper berries.
Oh, autumnal.
So that makes a, I mean, it does look great on the table as well because you can use those beautiful brightly colored heirloom carrots or just regular baby orange carrots and then really thinly sliced beautiful red and white radish. Looks gorgeous together. And I like to finish that with some arugula and then some labneh, which is, you know, that lovely creamy edge to this salad. It just works in combination perfectly.
Boy, that would wake everything up at the table too. And the great thing about both those salads is you can do most of the prep in advance.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So give me a couple ideas for things that we wouldn't think of for the Thanksgiving table.
Well, maybe something warming and a little bit kind of more comforting are my golden baked onions.
We don't bake onions for Thanksgiving. That sounds delicious. Well, how do you
don't
do them?
You? Okay. Oh, well, you cut onions and you put them cut side up so you can see all those nice lines. They actually take a long time to bake. So it's one of those things that you just throw in the bottom of the oven, maybe in the morning. So they need to bake covered for an hour and a half. But, you know, when you bake an onion for that long, it starts to really break down and the sweetness of the onion comes through and all that kind of acidity of the onion just melts away. So it's really important to bake it for that hour and a half. They're super soft. And then you just top them with a little bit of thyme, some Dijon, some cream, some smoked mozzarella, and some Gruyere.
Oh,
and that
my.
All bakes together. It's all bubbling. Oh, my goodness. It's so good.
It sounds just delicious.
Very nice. Very and then, good. Of course, I think the other thing that's becoming really popular, it seems to be really trending now, is cauliflower.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think of sides like you do, Sally. They have to be quite dramatic and, you know, they're like the good supporting actors in the role. So this one is a whole head of cauliflower and you actually kind of blanch it first, pre-cook it in stock, which is flavored, in chicken stock, which is flavored with sage and thyme and oregano and garlic. Yeah, so you're softening the cauliflower because you want to cook the whole head together so it looks really dramatic and glamorous on the table as well. So you cook it until it's soft and then you come, just brush it with some butter and some olive oil and you roast it so the outside is really crunchy, the inside's nice and soft. And then I like to finish it with a sumac salt, which is just really simple.
How beautiful.
Sea salt flake sumac and a tiny bit of dried chili just for kick. But it looks uber glamorous on the middle of the table
as well.
Very
dramatic.
Lovely big crunchy. Yeah.
Actually, in a perfect opportunity for vegetarians at the table.
Yeah.
Skip that turkey altogether. Donna, these are great ideas. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sally.
Donna Hay's latest book is The New Easy. Now you can find all those Thanksgiving side dish recipes that she talked about. I am making those onions at splendidtable.org. If there's a great mom-and-pop cafe or barbecue joint or chicken shack in the remotest of remote places, Jane and Michael Stern will find it and will report on it on their roadfood.com site and here. Jane, Michael, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
There's something I want to ask you. I know you're out discovering new places, but it's Thanksgiving. What are the regional differences that you've discovered for Thanksgiving around the country?
They're subtle, but they're huge.
that's a great answer, Michael.
Well, no, ask anyone what they have for Thanksgiving, and you know, 9 out of 10 people will say, "Oh, we have the usual." But of course, you know, the usual to somebody in New England who insists on having creamed onions with their Thanksgiving dinner is completely different than the usual from a cook in New Mexico who is likely going to stuff their turkey with a tamale kind of stuffing. Or what do you do with your candied yams. Are they candied? Are they yams? Are they sweet potatoes? If you're on the eastern shore of Virginia, you're going to serve beautiful sweet potatoes au naturel because they grow them there and they're really proud of them. If you're throughout much of Dixie, the Deep South, you're going to have lots of marshmallows melting on top of your sweet potatoes.
See, I have two thoughts on this, Lynn. Thought one is you can divide the United States in half by stuffing versus dressing. You know, that in the South, it's called dressing. In the Northeast, it's called stuffing.
But I think you have to divide the country into thirds, because you're forgetting about filling, which is what they have in Pennsylvania Dutch country, where the stuffing is is supplemented by mashed potatoes, as if it's not dense enough.
I did forget about that, and I think I will continue to forget about that. I'm not like that. The other thing that always strikes me about Thanksgiving is why there's never been a really great Thanksgiving cookbook, because everybody does their own family thing on Thanksgiving. And most people don't want a new, different recipe. They want what they've been eating for the last 50 years.
Jane, do you remember going to my aunt's house the year after the food processor became popular?
Oh, God. Yes. That was the year of the Cuisinart, and your aunt made puree of turkey or some such thing.
Everything. Every dish, every course was pureed at that Thanksgiving dinner.
Now, I want to know, what's wrong with that? I remember those days.
Well, I think in 30 years in the nursing home, I'll probably
when we have no teeth, yes.
So, but now you said, okay, so we're talking North and South, but there's a pretty vast area, and Pennsylvania, okay, Pennsylvania Dutch, but there's a pretty vast area out there. So how would you typify the rest of the country, Jane?
Well, you know, dressing and stuffing are just kind of two names for the same thing.
Right.
You know, it's just moistened bread with something in it. So there really isn't that much of a difference. And, you know, turkey is turkey everywhere.
Well, I beg to differ. I think one of the main differences at the Thanksgiving table is what you have for dessert. I think everyone, of course, wants that kind of orange pie, whether it's pumpkin pie or sweet potato pie, that's going to be at the Thanksgiving dinner. But, you know, if you're up in wine country in New York State, it's traditional there to have a Concord grape pie after your Thanksgiving dinner.
Ah.
And, you know, if up in Boston, the pie might be accompanied or sided by some Indian pudding, not even pie. And, you know, throughout the South, I mean, you have transparent pie, you have chess pie. And in many families, those are absolutely essential as part of the Thanksgiving dinner. In Texas, it would not be a Thanksgiving dinner without pecan pie for dessert.
Okay, but talk to me about the West Coast. What's typical Thanksgiving in California and the Northwest?
Well, we actually have been to Thanksgiving dinners in California where the stuffing was less about bread and seasoning and more about whatever wine was used to flavor it, where the stuffing really becomes almost way more interesting, really, than the turkey, because it becomes almost like a I don't want to call it a pâté because it's not that consistency, but it has the authority of a pâté. It's not just something that goes with the bird. It's like a dish unto itself.
Well, I think the Pacific Northwest is very traditional, but California is. And probably Southern California is a bit of an anomaly in that, as everything is in Southern California, it's lighter and more vegetable-focused, which, you know, I like good old Thanksgiving with lots of bread and fatty pies. And, you know, this is not, to me, the day of dieting. And, you know, I mean, who wants leftover vegetables for Thanksgiving the next day?
Well, potatoes are a vegetable. So you definitely want leftover potatoes to go with your hot turkey sandwich, right?
That's true. That's true.
Okay.
Well, but I wouldn't concentrate on California. I think we can just kind of let them go for now.
Well, thank you both, guys.
You're
and may
welcome.
You have a joyous and delicious holiday.
Thank you.
You too, Lynn.
You can find Jane and Michael Stern's picks at splendidtable.org. And while you're browsing the site, be sure to register for this month's giveaway. It's a 10-piece set of Ballerini nonstick cookware from Italy. And 14 of you will be winners. So get the details at splendidtable.org. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
think about it, every place on the planet celebrates a Thanksgiving. Maybe it's not the over the river and through the woods kind, but the idea is always the same. Giving thanks for what we've got instead of stewing over what we're missing. I think Chef Vikas Khanna is one of those people who instinctively knows this. If you live in India, you know him as host of MasterChef India. If you live anywhere, you might know his film series, Holy Kitchens, his work with the Dalai Lama, his Michelin-starred New York restaurant, Janoon, and his many books. The latest is Indian Harvest, classic and contemporary vegetarian dishes. Vikas, good to have you back.
Likewise.
Well, let's talk about your beginning, because I understand you were born with a club foot, which
yes.
must have made it... children can be cruel. It must have made it difficult.
You know, I've never participated in any activities, sports and anything. So, but, you know, it's also funny that my shoes were very big and extremely heavy and with the braces. So when I walked into the class, you know, I felt that it was like thunderstorms. So I'll just sit in the back of the class and not move till the end of the school. Because when I walked, it gave a chance for everyone to laugh. But, you know, I could laugh at them when I would cook as a child. I felt that, you know, cooking was something which made me equal to everyone else. It filled that gap of not being equal physically in some way.
That took you into, what, at 17, you had your own catering business.
I love when you said catering business. My father used to say you should call it catering charity. Because I never made money. So we were serving very simple food, me, my grandmother, and my mother. So if somebody loved the flat fried bread, what I was serving, I'll be so happy. I said, don't pay for it. And somebody didn't like the food or something, I'll say, please don't pay for it. My father said, just call it charity. And then one day I decided in 2000 to come to America because I had read this book, Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Oh,
Richard
yes.
Book.
Yeah, right, right, about flying.
Flying, and flying seemed to be something so impossible when, as a child, you never could walk properly. So that book was the main reason for me to come to America. I know this sounds really ridiculous to some people that how can a book like, it's almost like 70 pages book, it's not a big book. It's about this seagull who wants to fly higher, and everyone says, this is not how we do it. So that book really pushed me. And you wanted to fly, and there was no higher city or no higher space or stage than New York City to come. And my brother said, if you fail, you'd rather fail in New York City. I just loved that.
So, all right, you arrive in the United States. Now, did you have a job?
No, nothing. So the only space where I wanted to work was restaurants. So, you know, this is pre-9/11. The world was a little different, a lot different. But, you know, survival is something and resilience is something which New York teaches you. Not like no other city in the world. Then I went to Upper West Side and this was a small restaurant. And I went and asked them that, you know, can I help you in some way? And they said, fantastic. We need a dishwasher. It's going to be Christmas. It's going to be really busy. But a little later, I figured out that I was not good in waiting. So they told me to wait some tables. And I had no idea about what wild turkey was. The guys are saying, can I have wild turkey? I said, you should have tandoori chicken. And no idea what is wild turkey. So that didn't go very well. So
the whiskey. It must have been very surprised when you suggested chicken.
I kept telling him, oh, it has Indian spices. It has red color. Owner said, would you just leave right now?
But there's a point where you end up, well, you ended up with $3 in your pocket.
Yeah, I still celebrate my Christmas at the New York Rescue Mission because it reminds me of the space and time where I lived 2000 winters Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you couldn't get a telephone in that time without a social security number. So I didn't have a phone.
Ah.
So they didn't inform me that I was working part-time. So I just stand in the line at New York Rescue Mission. And they said, welcome and Merry Christmas. I thought that was a message for me that, yes, if the Jonathan Livingston seagull gets tired, there's a space for that little bird to sit and rest and breathe. it's so visually clear in my mind what I was going through. You know, we live so many days in our life, but there are few moments which are such strong impressions on our memory and head.
I remember you talked about the Dalai Lama and how you met the Dalai Lama the first time.
Oh, my God. I'm going to share something amazing with you. So on Dalai Lama's, His Holiness's 80th birthday, I made a cake made out of very thin breads, which I learned how to make them in Tibet from his hometown. So I layer those breads thinly. I do all my stuffings and everything, and I make a beautiful cake, and I take it to him. I put 80 candles, and I said, His Holiness, you can blow the candles. You know what he tells me?
What?
He says, in Buddhism, we don't want to cut off something's life to wish for our long life. I can't blow a candle.
Oh, my.
Oh, my. Like a god.
Okay.
So imagine it's 80 candles on a cake, and they're all like the wax is melting, and he takes out every candle individually outside. He didn't blow the candle. I thought it was so beautiful.
That it is.
Never thought of that perspective, you know.
Interesting.
Never forget that.
Well, this is a time of year for us here in America for giving thanks. You know, we have our Thanksgiving feast. So can you give us an idea for a Thanksgiving menu that you would do, a vegetarian menu of your food?
Sure. You know, when you're doing a book, you're always figuring out you got to make it more seasonal in some ways for
right.
people to understand what they can enjoy in certain part of the year. So we have slow-cooked yams with apples, an extremely simple recipe. That you cut the shallots, yams, put them together, and then you add a little bit of ground cumin seeds, some garlic to it. And then you can also thinly slice apples because this is this fall and this is some of the best apples grown at this time. And then you add a little bit of vegetable stock and then you dry roast it, like, you know, put it in the oven. And I love it because, you know, it's great because you can just put it in the oven when you're expecting the guests. So you have this thing without too much of work or being in the kitchen. You spend that time with the family and friends. And then I have this dish which is roasted eggplant and basil pilaf. Very simple. Take an eggplant, cut it into small dices, about half an inch or 1 inch by 1 inch. And then you combine it with a little bit of olive oil, balsamic vinegar, and oregano if you have it fresh, fantastic, or dried oregano works. A little bit of chili flakes. You toss everything together with salt, and then you cook it in the oven. This is very simple. And on the other side, what you do is that you can cook basmati rice in open water and then you can drain it.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple, 15 minutes to cook basmati rice. And then you can toss it with the eggplant and then you finish it off with fresh basil leaves. I think it's quite easy recipe and it can be done much in advance. That is something which is very important. And one dessert which I think is very interesting in this book is the persimmon vanilla cobbler.
Uh-huh.
A lot of us buy persimmon during this time, during the fall, and we do not know what to do with it sometimes because we find it's too hard or sometimes it's too astringent. But persimmon is a fantastic fruit because of its fantastic firm texture.
Mm-hmm.
You cut the persimmon, you toss a little bit of vanilla and a little bit of flour, pinch of sugar if it's not very sweet. Layer it in a pan and then you can make a nice cobbler crust, which is just flour, butter, sugar. But I've also added some sliced almonds. Toss it, layer it, bake it. Very, very simple. Just two steps to make a fantastic dessert for Thanksgiving.
Well, that sounds delicious. It's perfect. Because thank you so much,
yes.
And a very happy Thanksgiving to you.
You too. It's the best time of the year.
Vikas Khanna's book is Indian Harvest. Now, he left us with a vegetarian menu for the Thanksgiving table. The main event, pumpkin biryani with pistachios. Find all the recipes at splendidtable.org. This week, every form of media, from Facebook and radio to TV and magazines, has but one mission: deliver to us a magical Thanksgiving where we breeze through cooking the feast and appear at the table looking like we've just gotten back from vacation. One of the champs in this realm is Adam Rappaport, dynamite home cook and editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine. Adam, this is becoming an annual event. Welcome back.
That's good. Wait, we do Thanksgiving every year? Hold on, what?
Well, Adam, I want to talk about the What Can I Bring guide that you've done.
Yeah, I think either you're a guest at Thanksgiving and you always want to, hey, what can I bring? I want to contribute somehow. But it's a tricky question. It's not such an obvious answer. You can't just show up with a bottle of wine. You need to think about it.
Well, okay. What are the basic rules?
Do not bring a dish of food unless asked to bring a dish of food. There's nothing more annoying than, like, hey, I made this casserole. You're like, yeah, but we already have three casseroles. We don't need your casserole. Like, the host obviously spent a lot of time making a menu. Be mindful of that. So if they ask you to bring something, great, or say, can I bring a dish? Is there anything you'd like me to bring to help out?
What about this idea? You say here, guests shall not chop. What does this mean?
You cook, right? Stay out of the kitchen. Unless, don't be the person that's like, hey, do you got a cutting board I can borrow? And do you have any extra thyme around? Yeah, wait, I need some butter. And it's like, no. Like, it's okay to bring a dish, but the dish should either be assembled. We also talk about maybe you want to bring a salad and everything's ready to go in little plastic baggies and all you need to do is toss it together. You should also bring your own vessel. So if you're bringing a salad, bring it in a salad bowl. If you're bringing a side that you've been asked to bring, have a side container to put it in. Don't ask the dish, like, do you got a big pot or bowl I can borrow? Like, chances are all those bowls and pots are already spoken for.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I think everybody's been in this position at one point or another where you're already struggling.
Yeah, don't complicate matters. And don't say, can I heat this up? It's like, you know what? There's a turkey in the oven and there's probably some, like, sweet potatoes also. Your dish is not getting in there. That real estate is spoken for. Sorry, you got me all riled up, Lynn.
Well, I can understand. You know, either bring your own small oven or the devil with it. How about this thing about wine? Because it's tricky, isn't it? Everybody thinks to bring a bottle of wine.
Well, first of all, if you're going to bring wine, if you're going to bring really good wine, make sure it's clear that it's not to be served at the dinner table. Because if you bring them a beautiful bottle of Burgundy or Bordeaux, that's going to get thrown in there with the other 10 bottles they've got going, and they're not even going to realize that they're serving a really good bottle of wine. So it's like, wrap it up, put a little bow on it, say, hey, guys, this is for you for later. Enjoy whenever you'd like. Or if they do want you to bring a bottle to serve at the dinner, say, hey, what kind of wine would you like me to bring? What are you serving? And they said, oh, well, maybe either bring a Gruner Veltliner for the white course, or we are doing American Pinot Noir.
Right.
We love something from Oregon. And so if you're going to bring a white to be drunk, make sure it's chilled and make sure the red makes sense within the scope of the meal. You know, people who love food think out the menu. They think out the wine plan. Listen to them. Ask them for their input.
Great thought. How about the idea of flowers?
I love flowers. They should not be fragrant ever. They also should be cut short enough that if you want to put them on the table, you're not sort of looking over and around them to see the person opposite you. We also say, you know, bring them in a container, a vase of some sort that you're okay with leaving there. So maybe it's a cute little ball jar or something, or a old, the beautiful, like, sort of San Marzano tomato cans that you can sort of creatively use as a vase. But don't bring your crystal vase that you expect to bring home at the end of the night.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, let's now switch the whole thing. What could you bring? Some ideas maybe we haven't thought of.
What else? I mean, I love the morning after, something to think about. You know, the hosts are putting so much effort into the meal itself. Like, well, what about the next morning? It's like we talked about, maybe you make a beautiful homemade pancake mix that they can cook the next morning. A beautiful loaf of, like, Pullman bread for those leftover turkey sandwiches. Maybe some Duke's mayonnaise, the favorite of the South. Beautiful coffee. Coffee is great. Not everything has to be about the meal itself, because a lot of times, like I said, the host has already done the work. They've got the meal taken care of. But what about the next day or whatnot? You know, and then there's just gifts. One of our editors had a great idea of bringing a cool little a guest book where everyone can sign their name and talk about it. And that can sort of become a tradition for every time the host hosts a dinner party. They have a little guest book that their guests and friends can sign.
I like that idea, because this is something I don't think people think about. And it makes for such great memories.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's going to be happening at the Rappaport House this year?
God, Lynn, you're going to shoot me, but we have not locked in a plan yet. So there's my wife and our 7-year-old son, and then my mom, who's a very spry, go-getter 80-year-old who's actually off to Cuba on Saturday following Thanksgiving.
Bless her.
So she did not want to go down to D.C. with my brother and sister, so she needs to be in her home. She likes to pack. She's one of those types who packs 3 days ahead and then, you know, is counting the hours.
Mm-hmm.
So we might go to a friend's, quote-unquote, Friendsgiving, as the kids say these days, out in Brooklyn and whatnot, where it's like you're not going home, so you invite your friends over and everyone brings a dish and, you know, you sit around and drink craft beer and whatever, like the,
right,
and talk
right
about your beards. And so we might do that and bring my mom along.
It sounds like, yeah, I like that idea.
She's a very hip 80-year-old, so I don't worry about her. Give her a Doers on the Rocks, and she's good to go.
No, this reminds me. A friend of mine said to me, one of the things, he said, everybody does Thanksgiving. We've all had it. We've done it. And he had a movie party. He invited
cool.
a bunch of friends, and he picked a film he thought they'd all love, and they all went to the movies. And then after that, they went out for, I think it was pizza. And they
That's
all
great.
And they gave thanks for the fact that they didn't have to cook anything, and they did, and they had a wonderful time.
I do think it's important to mix it up. Michael Chabon, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, wrote a beautiful essay for us a few years ago in Bon Appetit about doing something different every now and then, and about not if you do the same thing over and over and over again, you almost become inured to it. You take it for granted. It just becomes by rote. If you shake it up, all of a sudden you become more appreciative for what a special holiday is, and your friends and your family. So if you're not with them one year, they might get a little hurt. But when you come back the next year, you'll be that much more appreciative, and you really will give thanks, and it'll be a heartfelt thanks.
That's a lovely idea. And may you have a lovely time with the beard and the beers and the craft beer and your mother and the whole family. And thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Take care. Adam Rappaport is editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit. Coming up, your calls, and we're talking to the brother-sister duo behind a vegetarian butcher shop. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late.
It is time to turn to your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up. Mimi is calling from New York City. Hey, Mimi, do you have a pressing question?
Oh, I do. I have a very pressing question. Apparently, my daughter and son-in-law didn't think a turkey was enough for Thanksgiving and have asked me to make what I used to make, a beef Wellington, which I haven't cooked since the 1970s.
That's not something you just kind of knock out in an afternoon.
Well, I used to be able to do that. The problem is I live a couple states away from my daughter and son-in-law.
Yeah.
And wondered if there was a way I could prepare this Wellington a day ahead, up to a certain point, and then do the puff pastry and bake it on Thanksgiving.
I think you have a superb idea. Because now, tell me how you did your Wellington. Was it with the tenderloin and you seared it first and you put the smear on it?
Yeah, I did. And I sort of thought I used Julia Child's recipe, but then I looked at it and said, no, this was not it. So I went back to Gourmet Magazine 1966.
Oh, my.
And found the recipe I used.
Uh-huh.
And I seared the meat first, and then I slapped it with the foie gras and the mushrooms.
Right.
Then I wrapped it in puff pastry and baked it. So I was concerned that if I did the searing of the meat and covered it with the foie gras and the mushrooms, it would get a really mushy feeling.
Yeah, it would. I think this is what I think you'd – and also, you have to transport it stone cold.
Right, and that's not a problem.
Okay.
I'm only 2 hours away, so it's –
Oh, all right. Okay. And you can have it on ice or whatever you need.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
This is what I would do personally. I would sear the meat, and it could be done a couple of days ahead. Mm-hmm. I would sear the meat, season it however you want, cool it down as fast as you can, wrap it securely, and refrigerate it. Mm-hmm. Get it really cold. I would make the coating you're going to put on it, the mushrooms and the foie gras, ahead of time. And then that would be thoroughly chilled in the refrigerator.
Separately.
Not right. together. And mm-hmm. then I would have the puff pastry ready, and you're going to deal with the puff pastry when you get there. And okay. you should tell them you're going to need space. You're going to need the oven. You know, if this is a lovely thing that they want you to do, but they're going to have to make sure that you have everything you need. And I would ask for a sous chef. I would ask, look, this is not saying could you throw together, you know, a takeout baked ham. This is saying you're going to make a real event out of this thing. But I think you could travel with that very easily. And then when you get there, you want to get the meat warmed up a bit, because mm-hmm. otherwise it'll be cold in the center and the puff pastry will be practically burnt, you know. Now, well, you want to get the meat to warm up a bit, and it wouldn't be a bad idea to all by itself stick it in the oven, low oven, 300 degrees, let it warm up so that it is, I don't know. When you wrap the meat, was it warm normally or was it cooled?
Well, let me think. It was a long time ago. I think I cooled it.
Yeah, I think so too, because the filling wouldn't stick. Okay,
right, right.
So get it. You know what? Because it's been a long time for me too. Room temperature. Okay.
Right, okay.
All right. And then have that schmear, which I keep thinking of it as a schmear. But anyway, have the foie gras mushroom on the cool side, you know, slather. And then you have your puff pastry, which you've prepared and all of that. And then you bake it off.
Okay. I kind of thought that's what I should do, but I just wanted confirmation.
Yeah, I understand, because I would be the same way.
my daughter has three ovens and counter space, so
we're good.
That shouldn't be a problem, but it's been a long time.
I fully understand. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. It sounds so elegant, I can't stand it.
Thank you very much.
You take care, Mimi.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We have Patrick calling from Altoona, Pennsylvania. Have I totally mispronounced your name?
No, you got it right. It's just like Patrick, but with a D.
Okay. Did you have a question?
Well, all the healthy people have taken all the fun out of Thanksgiving. We're not allowed to cook the stuffing in the turkey anymore. I was wondering, could you butterfly the turkey and put it over a pan of stuffing?
You sure could.
Oh, wow, because that would mean you'd have a whole lot more stuffing.
Well, either if you want to do the whole pan, but now remember something. That turkey's going to throw off a lot of, if you'll pardon the expression, and the healthful people get upset, but it's one day. That turkey's going to throw off a lot of delicious fat. And the pan juices with whatever seasoning you have on that turkey are going to make the most delicious sauce, you know, in the pan. So what I'm wondering is, what if you were to kind of group all of the stuffing in, you know, so that it's under the turkey? It's still going to get a little soppy, which I think is wonderful because it's getting soppy with total flavor. But that way you can use some of those pan juices. And if it has some stuffing in it, who cares, to make mm-hmm. a delicious gravy. I think it's a brilliant idea. Absolutely
right.
Brilliant.
Well, I'm going to have to experiment with this.
Hey, have a wonderful holiday, and it's a great idea.
Thank you. Have a great holiday, too.
You too. Take care. 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We've got Robin calling from Pendleton, Oregon. Robin, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Thank you for taking my call. Well, we moved to a farm about 2 years ago, and I found out the garden grows lovage, sage, and butternut squash very well.
Ooh.
I had three butternut squash plants that took over my front yard, and I have 70 squash.
Oh, 70?
Yes.
Okay.
And I have a butternut squash soup I make, and that's about it.
Well, butternut squash makes the best pumpkin pie in the whole world. You know, you split it in half, get rid of the seeds, put it cut side down on an oiled baking sheet. about 400 degrees for an hour to an hour and a half until a knife just sinks into it. It has to be very soft. Let it cool down, scrape it out, puree it, and then measure it out for your pumpkin pie. And you can freeze the rest, or you can turn it into a vegetable in the sense that you have this as a puree. And then what you work into it is lots of minced sauteed onion, garlic, and fresh herbs. And do that in olive oil or butter. And just stir that in as though you're making mashed potatoes.
Oh.
Yeah, it's delicious.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, and then some people like to stir in roasted nuts or top it with roasted nuts. So there's two things you can get from one action. And roasted squash freezes really well. It'll throw off water when you defrost it. Just whip it. Let's see, what else can we do with butternut squash? Oh, you know what's delicious? Cube it, toss it with olive oil, cinnamon, black pepper, a little bit of chili, and lime rind. You know that you've lime zest.
Lime.
Yeah. And then slow roast it, turning it, okay, until it's kind of golden, a little crispy, and you'll taste it. And you'll see the cinnamon comes through, the black pepper comes through, and the chili comes through. Not super hot, but just enough. And if you want to, just the smallest amount of brown sugar could go in the mix. And then what I love to do is I get it so it's a little crusty and whatever on the outside. And then what I do is I just put it out at room temperature for drinks. Or serve it as a side dish. But it's lovely because, you know, the small cubes, you just pop them in your mouth.
I was thinking that would be an appetizer for Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. So hopefully that'll put you on the path, so to speak.
I think it will. My friends will receive less squash now.
It's like the zucchini. 70 yep. Butternut squash. Hey, have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too.
Take care.
Bye.
Remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252. Butchers are up there with farmers as food stars. So we've got traditional butchers, hipster butchers, and DIY home butchers. And now, yes, vegan butchers. The sister and brother team, Aubrey and Kale Walsh, of the Herbivorous Butcher, have been making and selling out of their meat-free meats in Minneapolis for 2 years. Industrial meat substitutes did nothing for them, so they created their own meatless sausages, Korean-style ribs, jerkies, cheeses, and more. Our contributor, Francis Lamb, got to see just how they do this and to ask, so what does make meat so craveable?
So, Aubrey, Kale, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you for having
thank
us.
Thank you. I really want to talk with you because at one point in time, if you said to me the phrase meat-free butcher shop, I would be like, oh, sound of one hand clapping. But you guys have managed to make the phrase meat-free butcher shop not just a brain twister or a Zen koan, but an actual business. And you make plant-based sausages and ribs and all these different meat-like products. But the first thing I want to ask you, and I think it's sort of an interesting question to ask someone who doesn't eat meat, is what makes meat meaty? What do people who miss the taste of meat miss about it?
For me, I went vegan 4 years ago, so I'm the most recent meat eater. For me, it's just kind of that, you know, that kind of that filling feeling, you know, that sticks to your ribs. You know, it's satisfying.
I mean, I think what people are trying to find when they don't want to eat meat, but they want a meat substitute, is they're looking for that heft. They're looking for something that has that meaty texture and sort of that umami flavor, you know, something you can eat with a starch and a vegetable and it makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of how it sort of completes a plate, I think. And then, you know, how we do it, it has all the same protein. It has all the same, you know, amino acids and B vitamins that you would get out of an actual animal product.
And for a lot of people, it's a memory too. You know,
oh yeah.
You know, gathering around the dinner table, eating ribs. You know, it's a memory that we had, and
yeah,
we wanted to recreate that. So,
Yeah, I think that the tradition part of it is actually really interesting because, you know, there is something for a lot of people where you have these memories of growing up, and the centerpiece of the table is a roast or is something like that, and there's this feeling of that kind of eating and that kind of sharing that just feels different if it's not there.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah, definitely.
I mean, every holiday, you think of certain meats that go with every holiday, right? 4th of July, you have brats, you have hot dogs, burgers, stuff like that. Holidays, you know, turkey, that's what people think of. And so,
like a Christmas ham.
Yeah, so
you know, you can create that family tradition in a totally vegan way.
Mm. And so, okay, let's talk about recreation then. How do you do that? How do you taste a meat product and break down the experience of eating, say, a sausage or rib? And how do you recreate that?
Sure. So getting the flavor is actually pretty easy. You know, you can use things like nutritional yeast to create a savory flavor, different beans, different herbs, different juices. But getting the texture right is the great difficulty. It's a game of proportions, liquid to dry. Making our products is like making a dough, sort of.
Like a bakery.
Yeah, it's like a bakery, like a savory bakery. Mm. And, you know, we use a heritage wheat as the base and, you know, different proportions of that in proportion to juices and the other dry ingredients we make can create anything from chicken to ribs to Iberian ham, if you like.
And as far as flavors go, you know, we have people that taste our products that still, you know, consume animal products.
Yeah.
Nothing gets out on the market unless our father tries it. It's just a thing that
our harshest critic.
Yep.
So you bring up your father, and I know that your family is from Guam. So
yeah.
So I don't know too much about the food of Guam. So is being vegetarian like a thing on Guam?
No, absolutely not.
Impossible.
Growing up on Guam, for me, our family meals had 4 or 5 meat products on the table. My grandma would grill T-bone, and then she would grill New York strip steak and chicken and hot dogs, sometimes Spam on the grill. So there's absolutely nothing about Guamanian food that is vegetarian. We don't really have that many vegetables on Guam. When I was growing up, we didn't really even import anything. So I didn't know what Swiss chard was. We had iceberg lettuce and, you know, tomatoes. So it is really difficult to be a vegetarian on Guam.
And does that experience influence what you do now?
You know, yes and no. I really wanted to eat a lot of the food that I ate growing up. And Kale didn't get to enjoy that stuff with our family when we lived there. So when we came here, we were trying to, you know, sort of give him that family tradition again. And we weren't able to because I didn't eat meat.
That's you ruined basically. My childhood.
Sorry. Yeah, we've been trying to make Spam for a long time, and we haven't gotten there yet.
It's an uphill battle.
It really is. It's my personal Everest.
So is Spam the hardest thing to recreate?
Yes, it is.
I don't know.
It is.
I don't know. Salmon.
Oh, well, salmon, we've never eaten fish in our lives, so that's why we can't create fish. But Spam is something so special about the you know, the sound it makes when it comes out of the can, and I just can't
the,
duplicate
the gelatinous
that.
Mass on top.
What is your biggest seller?
You know, it changes. For a while there, it was our Italian sausage.
More recently this year, we introduced our line of cheese-free cheese also, which has really been taken off.
Yeah, I mean, you can really use it like cheese. I made a cheese sauce just by melting some of our cheese and adding some vegan cream cheese and some other flavorings, and I just made a cheese sauce just like, you know, everyone else.
Yeah, that's the thing a lot of our customers are excited about. Like, most of our customers are flexitarian, like at least 60 to 70% of people are omnivores that like doing a meat-free Monday, you know, vegan before 6, something like that. And they just like that they can sub out our stuff for the meat and their recipes one for one. So
yeah, so it's not about dogma, it's about having options.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you guys so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Aubrey and Kale Walsh are the owners of the Herbivorous Butcher, based in Minneapolis. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Kevin James, who said, "Thanksgiving, man, not a good day to be my pants." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to join us on Thanksgiving Day for our annual Thanksgiving call-in, Turkey Confidential. This year, it's Mario Batali, Bridget Lancaster from America's Test Kitchen, Francis Lamb, Melissa Clark, and you never know who else. Check your local station schedule or listen to us online. And while we're talking Thanksgiving, don't miss out on this year's Thanksgiving menu from our friends at America's Test Kitchen. We've got you covered. Just go to splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk next week.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.